I think this is the best we can do. I think this is the wisest approach we can make, maybe not the best.
Working toward an increase in school funding for students. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, January 30th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Bering Sea ice is blocking fisheries now, but it may prove beneficial later.
We've had four cold years. We've returned back to where we were in the 1980s and 90s.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the statewide BP Teachers of Excellence Program. Nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com. Nominations are due by February 14th. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2012 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
The Senate Education Committee this morning approved an increase to the Basic Student Allocation, or BSA. The BSA is the amount of money given to cover the cost of educating each student on the rolls, and it is the basis for calculating extra costs, such as the difference in operating expenses in different communities. Last year, instead of an increased BSA, schools shared in a one-time grant of $20 million, but that wasn't automatically renewed and was not money that schools could use in the budgets they're working on now. In a hearing last Friday, the Alaska Council of School Administrators said that schools actually need a $320 per student increase this year just to keep up. But Senate President Gary Stevens balanced that figure with an amount that might be possible to get from the House and the governor.
There's a lot of work ahead for all of us in this room. If you find that there's support for $320, I'd be delighted. But I don't think that's the reality of it. I think this is the best we can do. I think this is the wisest approach we can make, maybe not the best, but I do appreciate the fact that we have a bill here and that we have a lot of work ahead of us to try to make sure that it gets through the entire process.
The bill increases the BSA for each of the next 3 years, $125 for the budgets being written now, $130 for the following year, and $135 for the 2015 budget. Sonny Hiltz of the Kenai School Board praised the committee's decision to provide more than 1 year of funding. She said forward funding will allow schools to plan ahead.
What it does in our school district is it changes the morale of the entire place. It lets us focus on what we know will work, and a program doesn't work for 1 year and then start over again. We have to be able to plan ahead.
House Speaker Mike Chenault didn't make a prediction on the outcome of the increase when it gets to the House. He told reporters this morning that he thinks education needs more state money, but he says he has a problem with making a commitment to a formula.
Putting something into law that it can certainly be changed, but sometimes it's a lot harder to change it once you put it in. So I think we've got to be careful. Could we come up with something that's a year or 2 or 3 years certainty for education? We've done it in the past. We could certainly do it in the future, but I think that we have to have those conversations as we look at the budget continuing to grow.
The BSA increase is now before the Senate Finance Committee. In the House, a bill just introduced would inflation-proof education funding. HB 143 would require the administration to increase the base student allocation by at least the annual rise in the Anchorage Consumer Price Index. Anchorage Democrat Representative Pete Peterson's bill would provide an additional $187.52 for each student. The Renda and Healy are out of the ice. After more than a week of cutting through ice up to 4 feet thick, both the tanker Renda and the Coast Guard icebreaker Healy crossed into open water about 1 p.m. yesterday. As of earlier today, the tanker was transiting on open water outside of Dutch Harbor. The Renda is now making for her home port of Vladivostok, while the Healy returns to Seattle. The tanker was escorted to Nome by the U.S. Coast Guard cutter Healy to deliver 1.3 million gallons of fuel earlier this month. After the fuel delivery was completed and the ships began their transit south, the sea ice had grown more than 60 miles. Bering Sea ice came in quickly this year, and right now it's at its largest extent since the 1970s. It's effectively shut down the snow crab fishery, causing problems for boats as far south as the Aleutians. But some scientists say that while it's a pain in the short term, the ice is good for the Bering Sea's valuable fisheries in the long run. KUCB's Stephanie Joyce reports.
When this winter started, the ice extent in the Bering Sea was looking pretty average. But in the past couple of weeks, that's changed. The ice is now covering an area roughly the size of Texas. That's according to Andy Mahoney, a sea ice researcher at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He says the 30-year average is about a third less than that, covering an area more like California. Part of the reason for the increase is a persistent low-pressure system in the Arctic.
And that creates a situation where the cold air doesn't leave the Arctic as frequently. And as a result, the cold air stays in the Arctic. The Arctic stays colder.
But in other northern waters, the sea ice extent is shrinking. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration climate scientist Jim Overland says the Bering Sea frequently doesn't track with the rest of the Arctic. As average Arctic ice extents have gone down over the last 30 years, the Bering Sea has actually seen a slight increase. Overland says that's because despite climate change, the Bering Sea is mostly dictated by storms.
The Bering Sea tends to continue to do its own thing this year and in the foreseeable future that's based upon how the North Pacific storm tracks behave.
Since 2006, the Bering Sea has been in a cold phase. But before that, from 2000 to 2005, the Bering Sea was at the other extreme, record warm temperatures. According to Overland, these blocks of temperature don't represent any pattern, and they can have a huge impact on the ocean ecosystem.
You have this random climate extreme, and it's like a hammer hitting the bell where you just strike the bell a couple of times with a hammer and then you stop the hammer, but the bell can continue to ring. So the biology would be the continuing effect of the shorter random events.
Back in the 1970s, there was a period of temperatures as cool as the current ones that Overland says caused a major reorganization of the Bering Sea ecosystem.
The fact that pollock now dominates after the 1970s, perhaps the loss of cod in the 1930s was also related to one of these five-year events.
But Overland is less sure what this period of cool temperatures could mean for ocean ecosystems, especially given the stretch of warm weather at the beginning of the millennium.
If we continued to have a whole decade of warm temperatures, we might have precipitated some major event in the ecosystem, but I think the fact that we've had four cold years, we've returned back to where we were in the 1980s and 90s.
Alaska Fishery Center biologist Karim Iden agrees that the annual ice extent has a big impact on fish populations, but is a little more cautious about this year's effects.
It's not so much how much the ice covers at this time of year, but more how the ice melts back, how fast it melts back into the spring and the summer.
Iden says the biggest impact is on pollock, Southwest Alaska's biggest fishery, but also snow crab. He says consensus is emerging in the scientific community around the idea that colder springtime temperatures are better for pollock stocks because of how they affect plankton growth. But he says it's still unclear whether this year will be one of those years.
Not so much the past few, but there have been years in the past where we've seen very cold winters, but then things have warmed up pretty quickly.
The ice extent is expected to remain high for at least another month. Reporting in on Alaska, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
The interior is coming off a weekend during which Fairbanks and several other locations had low temperatures in excess of 50 below zero. National Weather Service meteorologist Corey Bogel says Galena had the coldest official reading.
They had a low of 65 below, which was quite impressive. They have records that go back into the 1930s, and their all-time record low was 70 below. That was back in the 89 cold snap. So that low of 65 below ranked as their third lowest temperature on record.
There's some relief in the forecast. Things begin moderating this morning with 32-40 below readings in Fairbanks as clouds and light snow moved in. Bogel says the longer range forecast is also encouraging.
There's a deep low in the North Pacific that's going to lift up into the northern Gulf of Alaska Wednesday and up towards the Anchorage area on Thursday, and that will bring with it a much milder air mass up to our area for late in the week.
Bogel says there may be a day or two as a cool down as the low moves out, but the extended forecast generally calls for milder air over the interior next week. He says the trend will be complemented by the sun.
Now that we're at the end of January, we have well over 6 hours of daylight, and we're gaining 7 minutes a day, and the sun angle is now up to about 8 degrees above the horizon, and continuing to get higher in the sky with each passing day. So it gets harder as we get into February to sustain the real low temperatures, especially during the day.
The interior is ready to say goodbye to January, which will be one of the top 10 coldest in Fairbanks recorded weather history. Bogel says there have been 16 days this month when the temperatures dipped to 40 below or colder. That's only surpassed by 4 other months in Fairbanks history. Residents in South Central will probably be happy to say so long to January also. This month ranks as one of the coldest Anchorage has experienced. APRN's Josh Edge has more.
With an average temperature of 3.8 degrees Fahrenheit through January 26th at the Ted Stevens International Airport, this month is on pace to be the fourth coldest recorded since 1953. According to Sam Albanese, the warning coordination meteorologist at the National Weather Service's Anchorage office, the frigid temperature has been a result of an amplified high pressure pattern over the mainland mixed with cold air coming out of the Arctic and Siberia. But he says that the weather pattern is changing, and there should be some warmer weather headed towards Anchorage.
We're looking at a more active weather pattern. We're going to see a low-pressure system barreling on up into the Bering Sea, which in turn creates more of a stronger southerly flow over the mainland, which brings a lot of that warmer marine air over the state.
Albanese says temperatures are expected to remain above zero tonight and should be getting consistently warmer through the weekend.
Tomorrow, some places may be as high as 20 degrees. Tomorrow night, 0 to 5 above, but as we get closer to the weekend, we're looking at temperatures even on Thursday where you might actually see some temperatures above freezing around 35 degrees, 25 to 35 there, and even right through Sunday, 25 to 35 degrees. So a significant warming compared to what we've been having, that's for sure.
For some other thoughts on Anchorage's cold weather, visit alaskapublic.org for a link to a report written by the National Weather Service's John Papineau. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Russian-bound flights could soon be leaving Alaska.
It looks like we'll have a schedule that allows us to arrive in Kamchatka in the morning.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Every Alaskan can make a difference when we file online for our PFD. You can shelter families in crisis, nourish the hungry and homeless, and protect those who have suffered abuse and neglect. And it's easy to share a little of your PFD through Pick, Click, Give. And good things will happen for the causes you care about. This message sponsored by Providence Health and Services Alaska and North Rim Bank.
Yukon Quest mushers brought their dog teams to a warehouse in South Fairbanks on Saturday to let race veterinarians look over all the dogs signed up to run. KUAC's Emily Schwing was there to find out what a veterinarian looks for and how they decide if a sled dog is race ready.
And this is?
Copper.
Hi, Copper.
Yukon Quest head veterinarian Kathleen McGill is checking over one of rookie musher Christy Barrington's dogs. Copper is clearly named for his color. He has dark brown eyes. He's a little nervous.
We're going to look at his teeth and his gums first. He's got nice pink gums, and his teeth look really good. No infections. Eyes are nice and clear. We check lymph nodes underneath their jaw here, and those look good.
Race rules allow mushers to run up to 14 dogs. That means the vets have about 350 dogs to look over. McGill presses her fingers into the front of Copper's shoulder, to the right of his chest, and just below the base of his neck.
Because sled dogs wear a harness, the harnesses can impact the point of the shoulder.
Copper has a minor cut on his foot. Barrington recently ran him in another race across Alaska's interior. He's wearing a maroon-colored bootie on his left paw.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's coming along just fine.
Yeah.
That looks good. He's not limping on it or
no,
anything?
No, he's been running. We just
okay.
McGill says injuries like this are par for the course when it comes to long-distance sled dogs. This will be her sixth year as the Quest's head vet.
The dogs can't speak. You know, they can howl and bark, but they can't tell us where it hurts. And so we as the veterinarian team are the advocates for the dogs. The mushers know their dogs very, very well. We know the medicine, and the two of us together as a team can do what's best for the dogs.
Dog care is no joke for race officials. Mushers can be disqualified from the race even before it starts if the animals aren't in good health. But that's not a concern for four-time finisher Mike Ellis. He and his wife Sue won the Veterinarian's Choice Award for dog care after the 2011 Yukon Quest.
This is more coming in and showing them off. The team just looks perfect. They're in great shape. We don't really have any issues. They're ready to go.
That sense of readiness is exactly what McGill is looking for. But she calls it BAR.
Bright, alert, reactive. If you have your own pet dog, when you come home, if that dog greets you and is happy and is wagging his tail and wants to lick your face and he's got bright eyes and is engaged with you, that's what we're looking for. But if a dog is really withdrawn, typically they don't feel good. So then we've got to look for something else.
McGill is just finishing up Copper's checkup.
Then we go back, we check the back, make sure they have enough fat along their back, over their hips. I check an Achilles tendon, make sure that's good. And any other swellings or lumps and bumps we might find that we need to explain. He looks good. So he's definitely a 5.
That score, 5, is for overall body condition.
So on a scale of 1 to 9, 9 being really obese, 1 being very skinny, ready to die. So ideal is 4 or 5 in there somewhere with an athletic dog.
After the physical, Copper's paperwork is finalized so he can cross the Canadian border. All of Christy Barrington's dogs checked out well, which calms the nerves of the 29-year-old Wisconsin native turned Alaskan, for now.
Yeah, every day it gets closer to the race, I feel a little bit better because, you know, food drops are due last week. Okay, that's out of the way. If I forgot something, oh well, I'm just screwed. And then now vet checks are out of the way, and I only brought 14 dogs, so if one didn't pass for some bizarre reason, I would have had to start with 13, so it's good to see that they all passed. I didn't have any doubts that they would, but that's, you know, just one more thing that's over with. And next step we have is the drawing banquet.
This is one of the final pre-race events where mushers and race personnel come together before it begins. All Yukon Quest rookies are required to attend the official race vet checks. Veteran Quest mushers can have their own vets check their dogs. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
This week, the Pebble Limited Partnership is releasing more than 20,000 pages of research they commissioned and paid for. Since 2004, more than 40 firms have been gathering data in and around the area envisioned for the controversial Pebble Mine. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
For the past couple of years, many observers of the Pebble Mine process have been waiting for the Pebble Limited Partnership to release the environmental baseline document. That document will be released to the public later this week, but state and federal agency representatives are getting a preview during 4 days of detailed presentations that begin Tuesday morning in Anchorage. Mike Heatwall is a spokesperson for the Pebble Limited Partnership.
We're going to have the consultants who undertook these extensive studies be presenting their work to state and federal agencies, and thought it would be a good idea, given the interest in Pebble and our environmental studies, to broadcast those sessions via the internet so that folks who are interested in tuning in may have that opportunity.
The presentations for the state and federal agency representatives begin Tuesday morning at 8:30 and will run through Friday afternoon. Tuesday morning's presentations will include a Pebble project engineering update, an overview of the environmental baseline document, and surface water hydrology. All of the presentations will be streamed online, and Heatwall says links to the web stream can be found online at pebblepartnership.com. He says the partnership will also make the presentations available for those who can't tune into the webcast or for those whose internet service does not accommodate a webcast.
If somebody is interested and may not be able to tune in over the course of these several days, we're going to be posting each individual presentation to the internet so folks can listen in that way. And then we'll also be recording the entire 4 days and putting that onto DVD so that somebody at the end of it, you know, can just shoot us a note via the contact page on our website, and we'll be happy to provide a full copy of the proceedings because we think that may be an easier way for people to be able to listen in on their own time.
Currently, the full environmental baseline document is not available to examine, but Heatwall anticipates that it should be available online by Wednesday at a special website at pebbleresearch.com. He confirms the document is huge, coming in at about 20,000 pages. The environmental baseline document covers the studies and research conducted between 2004 and 2008. Heatwall says work is still ongoing on the pre-feasibility document, which is basically the plan the Pebble Limited Partnership will follow to develop the mine. He says the goal is to finish work on that document later this year. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
Every Alaskan can make a difference when we file online for our PFD. You can shelter families in crisis, nourish the hungry and homeless, and protect those who have suffered abuse and neglect. And it's easy to share a little of your PFD through Pick, Click, Give. Good things will happen for the causes you care about. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority and BP.
Thousands of Horizon and Alaska Airlines workers will receive hefty bonuses in their paychecks next month. The Seattle-based airline group last week announced a second straight year of record annual profits. Chief Financial Officer Brandon Peterson says his company's planes are flying fuller than ever. It's also been able to offset high fuel costs with higher fares.
We're able to share generously with employees when the company is doing well, without embedding fixed compensation into our cost structure that becomes a burden in times that our financial results are not as strong.
Peterson says Alaska Air will pay bonuses equal to about 6.5% of pay to most staff. The airline group says all 12,782 employees qualified for bonuses. Separately, the airline's management estimated the cost of last week's crippling snow and ice storm in Seattle at $3.5 million. Most of that is lost revenue due to hundreds of flight cancellations. While the Anchorage Airport serves plenty of international cargo flights, there aren't many opportunities for Alaskans to get their passports stamped without passing through the lower 48. Now, one Russian airline is working to make Anchorage a jumping-off point for the Kamchatka Peninsula, and they've announced that they'll start selling tickets next month. KUCB's Alexandra Gutierrez has more.
Last year, Vladivostok Air announced that it would be flying passenger planes from Alaska to the Russian Far East during the summer season. Now, the airline has finalized its schedule and is preparing for a July 12th launch date. Currently, you have to fly down to Seattle and through Beijing, Tokyo, or Moscow if you want to get to Kamchatka. It's an expensive and time-consuming process, especially given the peninsula's proximity to Alaska. Mark Dudley is the North American sales manager for Vladivostok, and he says that their weekly summer service should make it a little less complicated for travelers to get to Petropavlovsk-Kamchatsky.
It looks like we'll have a schedule that allows us to arrive in Kamchatka in the morning, which will allow for fishermen to get out to the rivers and for business travelers to potentially connect to other destinations in eastern Russia the same day.
Dudley says that fly fishermen and hunters have shown the most interest in traveling to Kamchatka. Additionally, Vladivostok is trying to sell seats to scientists, businessmen, and nature enthusiasts. They're targeting adventure travelers, too.
You know, I already have surfers contacting me wanting to go surf off of Kamchatka.
Dudley adds that Vladivostok is also hoping to attract Alaskans who might have some personal connection to the region. Interested travelers can book flights through travel agents or directly through the airline. Prices aren't fixed, but the initial draft prices start at $1,700 for round-trip airfare. The service will run from July through mid-September. In Unalaska, I'm Alexander Gutierrez.
Longtime Juneau businessman and Chamber of Commerce luminary Romer Durr passed away last week at the age of 75. He's being remembered not just for his efforts to improve Juneau's economy, but for his participation in the capital city's first ever statehood celebration. From Juneau, KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
Romer Durr was 23 years old when Alaska became a state. President of the Junior Chamber of Commerce at the time, he helped organize a community celebration where he ended up ringing the statehood bell, even though it wasn't his job. He explained in this 2009 interview with KTOO.
I put together the celebration thing, and I had two girls, one to hold the Alaska flag, one to hold the new U.S. flag, another girl to ring the bell. They got busy at her work, and she couldn't come. So they kept saying, get it done. So I kept sending an emissary down there, and finally they said, you got to do it. So I did it. So it was strictly an accident that I did it.
50 years later, Durr rang the bell again at a ceremony marking Alaska's golden anniversary. Durr was on the Juneau Chamber of Commerce Board of Directors when Kathy Romick was hired as executive director. She says the bell story was just typical Romer.
Just get out of the way. This needs to be done.
Romick calls Durr both a colleague and a friend and says the chamber wouldn't be what it is today without him.
I think his father was one of the founders of our chamber, which is the second oldest in the state of Alaska. There was even a time when the chamber struggled here in Juneau, and Romer actually paid the staff out of his own pocket. I mean, that's how important the Chamber of Commerce and the organization was to Romer.
Durr owned Harry Plumbing and Heating in Juneau for many years. Former chamber president Chuck Collins served with him on the chamber board and says it's impossible to think of Juneau without him.
I don't think the Juneau business community would be the Juneau business community as it is without Romer and his dealings here. You know, Romer was one of those guys, he didn't mind telling you how he felt, whether you made him happy or not so happy.
Durr apparently died of a heart attack. He's survived by his wife, Lorraine, two daughters, two grandsons, and five great-grandchildren. He's preceded in death by a son and his first wife, Carol. Services will be held Tuesday at Chapel by the Lake. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ben Matheson and Matthew Smith in Nome, Rosemarie Alexander and Casey Kelly in Juneau, Emily Schwing and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Mike Mason in Dillingham, Alexander Gutierrez and Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska, and Tom Bonsi in Olympia, Washington. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Josh Edge from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. 8 hours after you quit smoking, your blood oxygen level returns to normal. In 3 months, your lung function improves up to 30%. And 10 years after you quit, your risk of dying from lung cancer is about half that of a smoker. But right now, you're one cigarette closer to cancer. Every cigarette makes you sick. So quit smoking today. Information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline. Rasmussen Foundation announces a March 1st deadline to apply for individual artist awards, which provide funding directly to artists to support their creative work. Learn more by participating in one of their informational teleconferences to be held in January. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.